Thank you very much. Thank you. The School of Information Studies came about in the sort of late 70s when our dean at the time, Robert Taylor, changed the School of Library Science to the School of Information Studies. And he had a faculty of folks teaching libraries, but increasingly faculty in technology and communication, and they all got together and said, what are we going to call ourselves? And they said, we have no idea. So information studies was, I think, as close as they could get to we have no idea and still be able to put it on a sign. I was thinking when I was driving in yesterday and I had the GPS telling me which bridge to go over and turning about the first time I drove into Pittsburgh. And the first time I drove into Pittsburgh, I was 17 years old, and my best friend was with me, and my parents said, go check out colleges. And so I was looking at Carnegie Mellon. I was the art student. Don't get too impressed. And then I drove up to Syracuse and Rochester Information Technology. But I remember my friend, we're getting closer and closer to Pittsburgh. He goes, so where is Carnegie Mellon? I said, it's in Pittsburgh. He goes, no, I got that. Where? I said, I don't know. There'll be signs. So all I remember was a gas station, and I think it was close to where the rivers meet, and then they just said, go up Forbes Avenue. And I thought, how easy, it's a main thoroughfare. What the hell? It's one way. No, it's two way. Now it's one way the other way. I mean, it is, oh, man. It's, now I understand how you keep people outside of Pittsburgh when you don't want them in. I get it. So, reinventing library services and librarians in a digital age, what does all that mean? Let's go at it. I believe that there is a rich, bright, and brilliant future for reference and for librarians in the future, but not if we keep doing it the way we're doing it. I think that we are in a time when there is a great amount of change, not only in what libraries do, but in the institutions that we serve. I think higher education is in the midst of a massive flux. Mostly it's ignoring it, but it's there. This idea that somehow we'll just wait out the recession and then we'll be exactly the same afterwards, I think, is being disproven quickly. One of the scariest, two scariest statistics I see. The first one is that people now have greater debt due to their academics than they do to credit cards. And while one can say, well, the credit card debt's gone down in the recession, it didn't go down that far compared to how high the educational one. The other one is that, in fact, there is a great chance that this will be the first generation that has lower academic achievement than their parents. And so when I look at all of that, I look at the change. I mean, the pressure from for-profits, we look at all of this, the resources that we use, how we communicate, how we transmit, the interdisciplinary, the breakdown of disciplines, the idea that students are requiring different and expecting different when they get here from models of we're going to do the classwork at home and the homework in the class and moving and shifting models. There's just a tremendous amount of change. And I look at that as a tremendous amount of opportunity. I was talking with another library director, and she was saying how librarians, they say, oh, my God, it's too much change. I don't know what to do. And she said, this is the best time ever to be a librarian because you get to make it up as you go. And not like we don't always, but now we really get to make it up as we go. So I want to talk about that, but actually I'm going to, as you heard, I'm a professor, which means that I don't know what reality is, but I visit it from time to time. So I want to start with language, because language says a lot. Language is very much a great indicator of how we think, right? And so how we use language, how we talk, how we communicate, how we understand, says a lot about what we prioritize, what we mean, what we think, how we structure stuff. And so, you know, in library land, we have lots of language. The other joke I get, and my IT colleagues in the audience will forgive me for this, but IT folks never say no. They never say no. What they do is they just start throwing acronyms at you till you go away, right? We would like to put this database online. Well, that's a great idea, but of course our LDAP server doesn't reference it. We'll have to tunnel through the firewall, and the firewall has the TCP IP, so we have to figure out which circuit. You run away. And I say, but you know, as a librarian, you can get them right back. But it's a MARC-based system, and we take in the MARC-based and we put it into XML, and then it has a relational database structure, so we can... Right? Let's face it, we can scare the hell out of people, too. I was a colleague, a former colleague at OCLC said this was not the first meeting she was at where the librarians had driven everyone else away, you know? So, I mean, you look at the language we use, public services and technical services. Actually, if you do this in the public library sector, my favorite misnomer is adult services, because there are a lot of disappointed people after they click on that link. But, you know, what are public services? You know, we don't, you know, we serve students and faculty. They're not public. They're not UN people. You know, and technical services and what is reference and instruction, circulation, preservation, et cetera. And half the time what we mean is, you know, people who can talk to people and people we keep away from them and whatever it is. So language matters, right? One of the things that we know is increasingly we need to shape the library structure, the organization, around whom we serve and not shape them around us, right? The days of bibliographic instruction are officially dead, just so we never have to say BI again. I mean, I don't know why those two letters, when you put them together, just sound so wrong. But what do you do? BI, I'm sorry. You know, we have treatments for that now. But this idea that we need to shape it around them, you know, we need to, does Pitt's library look like Pitt? Does Syracuse library look like Syracuse? Why do they look so similar? Should they? Shouldn't they? Not only the collections and the stacks, but how we do it. So the example was working with a research university, and they said, you know, we've broken this down to research and instruction. Because as a faculty member comes into us and says, you know, I have to teach. Can you give me some resources? Can you do it for me? Can you help my GA because I don't show up? Whatever it is. But I also do research, and I've got this 10-terabyte data set. Where can I drop that off? Right? I have to go to human subjects, and I have to prove that I'm keeping my data, and it's anonymized, and it's secure. And that used to be boxes in my office. And now, what is it? And where can I put it? And how can I make a part of that? I just got this great new NSF grant, and I want to build a website. Where does that go? And what happens when it gets hacked every third day? And I built it in WordPress that was secure, but, you know, yeah, not really. How do we support those services? I need metadata. I need to go in and organize these reports, these interviews, these records, these reports. And so suddenly, cataloging becomes a public service, right? This distinction between what we need and how we used to view it as back house, front house, is starting to get really stressed and strained. Perhaps, though, nowhere is it more clear of our language problems when we talk about them. You know them. They're the people who walk into our buildings or sometimes call us on the phone or sometimes just annoy us in many other ways. What do we call them? What do we call those people who utilize our services, who take advantage of it? You know, here are a few of them, right? Are they patrons? Now, this is where I get to tell you why I hate all of these. Not all of them. They're nice. But these patron. How many people here do Renaissance-style oil painting? All right, so we have like the patron of the library. Right? You know, this is not like we do reference and someone says, "I will sponsor you." You know, it doesn't happen. Customer, I hate customer. I hate customer a lot. I hate customer because they're not customers. That implies that they are, in essence, consuming our services and walking away. It's right next to information consumer. First of all, who doesn't consume information? It's like, you know, how is it possible to live without consuming information? And the second is, it's like they come in, they consume us, and they leave. There's a really intricate relationship, particularly in higher education, between the faculty, the library, the institution, our students. I mean, think about it. Many students come, and they rely upon our reputation to get their first job. Then they get their first job, their second job, their third job, they fall into some money. We rely upon them for our reputation. We are intricately linked to these folks throughout their entire careers. Faculty members the same way. While we all love to think that we're nice little independent agents, we have this really interesting mixed relationship between the institutions we serve. You know, we depend upon it. It depends upon us. If we're not here, it doesn't succeed. If it's not here, we don't succeed. This idea that there's somehow a producer and consumer relationship as a nice clear line doesn't work. The other thing is we'll talk about, which is if you're in the education business, the idea that someone can simply be a consumer, that can somehow take from you regardless of the format and structure is insane. Reader, like anyone reads these days. No. My son reads. He's frightening. In fact, my 8-year-old son, the bus comes to drop him off, and it leaves, and he didn't get off. And so my wife instantly is on the phone to the school, what happened, everything else. Now, it goes around this big loop, and it comes back to another corner. So she directs me, on that corner, throw your body in front of the bus, see if he's still there. And so the bus stops. My 8-year-old son pops off, and the bus driver says, yeah, he missed his stop because he was too busy. He was too busy with his book. And my son, 7 years old, looks up to me and goes, yep, guess I'm a reader now, and walks home. So reader's not bad. User. Now, user is one of those terms that works beautifully. We use it, but when you think about it for a moment, first of all, the classic joke is that only computer scientists and drug dealers have users. But it has this same connotation of someone who uses you, like there's nothing left over afterwards, that you're a consumable. It also, I'm giving a talk at the school, the information school later, where I'm going to go into this more, it sort of says that you're a system, and the system has a user. Well, the thing is that these people are much more interesting than just coming into your building. We know this all over, right? When someone comes into the library, we may be the last stop. We may be the first stop, but we're certainly not the only stop, right? They're asking their buddies, they're asking their friends, they're asking their faculty, they're going to websites where they can buy theses, whatever it is. You know, it's much more complex than we are some big machine and you are all nice pieces. Right? In library science education, we've gotten out of the business of training spare parts. Right? Sally, the reference librarian, dies. Wheel out Sally. Wheel in new Sally. Right? This idea that we're interchangeable parts doesn't happen. Right? We're both a technical service, a science, a humanity, a craft. It's a much more complex relationship than that. So, in presenting this problem, a couple of people have done surveys, and my favorite is Joan Fry Williams was part of a strategic planning. And she said, I've got an idea, wait here, left the strategic planning, went radical concept onto the floor of the library and started asking people, what do we call you, what do we call you, what do we call you? And the answer that she got, and the answer that many people have gotten when presented the option is member, right? That I've got a card, you know, I pay dues or tuition or taxes or something, I'm a member. The thing to remember is that you're not a user. You're not a customer, you're not a consumer, you're a participant in control of your own world and able to shape your own learning environments. When you walk in here, we don't go, you're a Pitt employee, this is how you think now, right? We don't say, this is exactly how you'll do it. It's not that we're cogs, we're hired to think, we're hired to react, we're hired to shape. So when we look at our services, when we look at how we provide it, when we look at this, we're in control. When you look at people who go to Facebook, why do they go to Facebook? Because they can build a system around themselves. They can get their friends in and use their language and add farming on the side. Right. But it's not just a matter of vanity press. They're shaping this world. Now they can rapidly share information and get opinions from people they care about. When you look at how they twist the, I mean, you guys probably should if you don't already have a hack, you know, hack the university course, where, you know, the amazing machinations they can do around bursar accounts and twisting this. I mean, they don't simply take what's given. They figure out the loopholes and the shortcuts. They're shaping. They're shaping the world. You're not a consumer, you're not in your environment, and so are those that we seek. We seek to serve not customers or consumers, but members. We seek to serve people who are part of us. And now, I use this word, member, really specifically. Actually, I had a really great suggestion. A public library uses, Dallas Public Library is starting to use the term neighbor. And it has a very different feel to it. It has a very different understanding about it. And it's going to require a pretty significant change in how we look at our services and what we provide. First of all, members are learning and in a learning conversation. Now, we all are in a learning conversation, but particularly when you're higher education, you're allowed to say this explicitly. You're here to learn. Our faculty members, we may not say it that explicitly, but they're here to discover, to learn, do new things. And that learning is a conversation. So this comes from learning theory and wonderful abstract things, but it goes like this. When you're reading a book, you're having a conversation. You're not having a conversation with the book. It's dead, right? You're not having a conversation with the author. They could well be dead as well. They're certainly not sitting in the room going, hey, I had this great thing. You're right. Hamlet was crazy. What was I thinking? Right? You're having a conversation with yourself. do I believe this? Don't I believe this? Is this true? Did that make any sense? And if you're just sitting there right now going, what is he talking about? Who are you talking to? Right? We talk to ourselves all the time. We try not to do that in front of other people, but we are constantly having a conversation. When you woke up this morning and said, tie, no tie, whatever it is, who are you talking to? Yourself. I mean, I don't know if you're like this. Have you ever done this where you're walking down and you see like two places you want to go on either end of the street? You start up one and you go... Right? That's where you're having an argument with yourself. And you, right? But this conversation that we're having is about how we do it better. And what we're looking at, not only do we have these conversations with ourselves, this is what we're talking to our friends. A classroom is a conversation. Now, it's a very lopsided conversation. I don't want to pretend that it's grand and glorious, right? But we're having lots of conversations right now, primarily me to you, but in your minds, you're figuring out, do I care? Do I pay attention? Don't I? How does this match? That's a lot of work that you're doing. But that means that if we're in the learning business, we're in the conversation business. I would argue that libraries aren't in the information business. First of all, as an information scientist, I don't know what information is. By the way, it's okay that I don't know what information is. I mean, the physicists don't know what reality is. So we're, you know, I'm okay. And what the physicist thinks chemistry is just applied physics. So, we're in the conversation business. Now, in reference, this gets really clear. Yes, we have interviews, people come and they talk to us. But in technical services, you're in the conversation business. I had a great cataloger who talked about the idea of a MARC record is really a pre-fact reference interview. When someone's looking for this, what are they going to look for? They're really trying to use terms of art, literary warrant, whatever you want to call it, is really mapping this resource to the conversation that's happening. And when we look at it that way, suddenly things really change. Now we need services and tools that both shape and are shaped by the conversation. Now, this is the other reason that I sort of push against this notion of a user-based paradigm and user experiences, is it sounds like it's a very user-in-control world. Batya Friedman, who's at the University of Washington, has done work in value-added systems, but I think it's probably better expressed by Bill Nye, who once said, you know, the Mac operating system was developed by 13-year-olds for 13-year-olds. You know, if you don't get that, if you don't see the paradigm, it doesn't make sense. So I'm a Mac user. I'm a 13-year-old at heart. But, you know, I'm a really good Mac user. You put me on a PC, I got no clue what's going on. Right? The idea that somehow this is designed for a user, that's not true. It shapes you. I mean, have you ever found a friend who starts talking about they LOL'd the other day? And you're like, really? Or I was in a meeting and someone said it and this person next to me went, OMG, OMG, OMG. I'm like, you're not texting. Stop it. Right? It's like, life needs to be shortened. I don't know what it is. But the idea here is that where did we get that? The texting, the technology shaped how we started doing things. It shapes how we understand things. It's not neutral. As a library, you shape your users as much as they're shaping you. And that's a really different perspective. I was at another library. I'd mentioned it in the previous panel, but for those who weren't here, I was at another library and it was sort of not in its best heyday, right? It was going through a massive reorganization because it desperately needed one. And they brought in the faculty senate that oversaw this library, and I said to these folks, I said, so what are the university priorities that this library can shape itself around? Is it increasing research, undergraduate education, internationalization? What is it? And their response was, we need better access to back journals. I said, okay, that's great. So are you trying to grow the population of undergraduates, shrink the IAPA? We need really, the journals aren't working very well. And after like four or five times going back, it finally struck me. What happened was the library had trained these folks perfectly. Right? Here was their oversight, and they had been trained. This is who needed better access to back journals. Probably the library did. And so they had trained it. And so suddenly when you said to them, well, we've got an idea. What if a librarian came to, you got a list of everyone going up for tenure that year, came to their office and said, hi, my name's Dave. I'll be your tenure librarian. Could you please give me all your citations? I'm going to go do a citation analysis for you. And they looked at me and they said, they can do that? It's like, they can do whatever you want, you know. And so suddenly they begin, oh, wait, I never thought about that. I never thought about that. We shape this conversation. And so one of the questions you need to ask for reference service, for cataloging, for library service in general, is this the shape that we want to train them in? Do we want to get stuck in this shape? is this shape match what's going on into the classroom, into the larger settings? Does it go into distance education? I mean, I imagine with distance education, because you have plenty of that here, change what you did in reserves. I mean, it made electronic reserves go from a nice idea to absolutely essential overnight, right? That shaped you. And so having a conversation with those departments wasn't simply a matter of going, well, it's nice you're doing distance education, we'll walk away. Now, on the other side, how many times have they introduced a new academic program and forgot to mention that it's going to take a massive collection activity, right? So that conversation, that communication changes what we do. So where does this lead? If we, instead of thinking of reference as users, instead of a library as someone who comes to us, consumes our stuff, and walks away, but instead look at it as a place where we're facilitating conversations and knowledge, where we're coming and we're helping them have conversations not only with us, but with each other, with peers all around the world. We heard about last night the idea of doing interlibrary loan services with China. You opened up a conversation that never existed before. Where does that lead? Well, let's sort of start at the easy level and work to more interesting, and then, as is an obligation of mine, I must bring in some sort of crappy sci-fi example. But first one, integrating reference transactions into the catalog and collections. What does that mean? Well, what if, for example, we already know that if we get so many interlibrary loan requests for a book and we just buy the book, that book will be used and circulated more than anything we do through our standard acquisitions, right? So that moves to things like member-driven acquisitions, and people want this. And that's fine. Baby steps forward, right? But what if, for example, when someone puts in a question to your catalog and it comes up with zero results, right? The zero result query. Read the error screen and you will come up with either you are stupid or the user is stupid, right? I am stupid. I'm sorry, we couldn't find anything you want. We suck. Here's interlibrary loan. We'll find it for you, right? The user stupid is, did you spell it right? Could you try it again? I think you meant this, but I don't know. What if instead it was, we can't find anything. Do you want to add it? Do you want to add that information? And so people can find not only books and materials, but standing reference questions and responses to those reference questions. When someone asked for that, they tended to get these types of materials, things like that. How can we integrate communities into here? Once again, I'll give you a public library example, but I think it's probably pretty applicable. This public library was built on this massive plot of land where they're going to do a huge housing development. But then, like, the people who bought the land ended up in prison and it didn't go well. So this library was sitting alone on this massive plot of forested land. But the developer, the one who hadn't been arrested yet, came up and said, you know, if you guys can rent a backhoe, I got no problems putting hiking trails and paths all through this place. And so now when people go and look up nutrition or look up physical fitness, the answer is not here's a book on physical fitness, it's turn around and start walking. Right? This idea that suddenly we can take realia, we can take activities, we can take events, and we can merge those together. Right? When you look up a book on computer science, it says, here's the materials on computer science, and here are some seminars coming up in the next day, next 5 weeks. All of that together. Right? And I know that we're getting to that with web discovery tools, but we need to go farther and farther with that. Go where the learning is. Now, if you think about conversations don't always happen right in front of you. There are, in fact, many of them happening right now, not in the library. So how can we get out there? Things like embedded librarians. How can we be in the departments doing office hours, for example? How can we be in the departments helping on research teams? I love this one. Many academic librarians are now following Twitter feeds from courses. So they're not actually going to all the courses, but they're following the Twitter feeds, and so as questions get popped up and as faculty know that's happening, it's like a fact checker built into the course. It's really frightening. And so you can say, hold on a sec, I'm going to tweet this, and my librarian will probably get back to me in a couple of minutes. And so the Twitter feed is actually their way of visiting multiple classrooms at the same time. Now, this one's getting even more interesting, embedded librarians within research teams in higher education. So I give Paul Gandel, who was the director and CIO at Rhode Island, is now at Syracuse, had a great idea. There was an imperative from the university to raise the research dollars coming into the university, to increase research funding. So what he did was he hired a librarian. But he didn't hire a librarian to sit in the library and help them search for things. He actually hired a librarian and he put them in high production research teams in the labs. In the second year of that program, all the labs hired the librarians away from the library to keep them. because they had found more research opportunities, more collaboration, more technology. This led to what we called cyber infrastructure facilitators. Horrible name, we got rid of it. But National Science Foundation was giving out cyber infrastructure money, so, you know, talking about shaping language. And so we were designing a curriculum, and we had four test dummy students who came through the master's program in cyber infrastructure facilitation. Three of them got hired before they could graduate, one immediately upon graduation. E-science. What we're finding is that the impact that librarians can have, the skill set that we have about facilitating conversation, finding materials, bringing people together, collaborating, is so valuable to what's happening in the pursuit of science, but it needs to happen in the pursuit of science. It needs to happen in that place. So where can we be? The idea of doing office hours within a department is great. But imagine kicking it up so that you go in and say, Dr. Lankus, I see you've just gotten a project from National Science Foundation on X, Y, or Z. Do you need a blog site for that? Do you need us to help with this? Can we set these kinds of things up? The idea of being proactive. Right? I mean, you go back to the tenure case where you have a tenure librarian. I love this. You have to do this because, one, if you go and help a faculty member and they get tenure, you are the best human being ever. You can ask them for small children and chocolate and they will provide it. Right? And if they don't get tenure, they leave before they can badmouth you. I just think there is a no-lose situation here. So the sci-fi example of this is many folks are looking at building apps and app development, and we've got an app for this, and yes, we can search the catalog with the app. But I want you to think about something else. So geofencing is my current favorite. Anyone geofencing? All right, here's what geofencing is. So you're walking around, most of you, and if you've bought a cell phone in the past 5 years, all of you, with a cell phone that has GPS built into it. Even if you don't have the Nightville GPS app, because of enhanced 911 services, it has a GPS unit in it. And so it knows where I am. And as we found out, Apple knows where I am, and Google knows where I am, and they're not happy, whatever it is. Well, geofencing says, if this thing knows where I am, what I can begin to do is set coordinates. So I can say 10 feet around me is XYZ. So the silly example is Apple's new version of the operating system has a reminder app, buy milk, do this, you know, et cetera. But not only can you say, give it a date, you can give it a location. So when I go into the store, I'll pop something going, don't forget to buy milk. It just saved my butt many a time, right? But you can imagine, you know, when I leave the building, remember to lock up after myself, whatever it is. But what we're now talking about is imagine that you were going to, we're looking in terms of disaster preparedness. When you walk into a place like Joplin, when you walk into a place that would literally be in Haiti, that's wiped out, and you want to set up a library, and you go, why would you want to set up a library in this? Because they need reference service. They need services to FEMA. They need what we can provide. And if we don't have the physical bits around us, we can bring much of the library services with us. Imagine if you walked in and said, this is now the business section. This is now the relief section. And so as people walk in, their phones will say, do you have a question about FEMA? Do you have a question about this? Now imagine going one sense, which is we're now talking about members. Why do we stop at just where they can find us? Imagine now if you said, you know, I happen to be a professor of library science. I'm willing to answer questions on that. Here's a professor of physics. Here's a student who knows about model rockets. And imagine them walking around, and every time you're in proximity goes, hey, do you have a question on this? Or you have standing queries, where you're literally turning the people in your building and outside of your building into your collection that's advertising what they can do. So the idea here is that we're really looking at how can we turn our communities into our collections, not optimize our collections for our communities. Another quick silly example, then I'll get done. I'm at the Trevi Fountain. That's my lovely wife, and I pull out my iPad. I know, I'm at the Trevi Fountain with my lovely wife, and I pull out my iPad. These are my problems to deal with, folks. And so now what I can do is I can say, you know, bring up, and it knows where I am. It knows where I am. That's correct, isn't it? It knows it and says, oh, you're at the Trevi Fountain. But not only does it know where I am, but it can say, you know, we have these experts all around the world that are ready to answer your questions. They're online. They're ready right now. Right? And now, so I can pick one and I can go into a conversation about the Trevi Fountain and who is that crazy guy up there with a trident and all this other stuff. And then I can even get things like, oh, well, that's Oceanus, the god of water. And they can push it and they can point to it because they know where it is that knows where I am. with augmented reality stuff. You can even have a train of questions that are going by, so you can see what kind of questions were being asked here. You can even have standing queries like, where's a good place to eat wherever I am? Turns out there's a good restaurant 300 meters away. Now, first of all, the technology to do this is here. It's just a matter of us doing it. And frankly, doing these are not that hard anymore because the development platforms are getting good. What I want you to think about for a moment is there's no desk here. There's no reference person waiting for that. It's a community that's happening. It's a conversation around the interests that we're having. So let me just end with this concept, which is going from things like member-driven acquisitions process and liaison librarians to the iPad app. There's really easy to anywhere along the line go, oh, well, we couldn't do that. Oh, that's too crazy. That's too far out. Now is the time for big ideas. Now is the time for huge ideas. These are the ideas that should crush you under the weight of their bigness. Because that's the world that we live in. We live in a world which right now is wrestling with how higher education works, where it's wrestling with digitization platforms on a daily basis. So we were having a conversation at dinner last night that scholarly communication has been imploding for about 40 years now. True, but it's accelerating. And the idea is we should be able to jump in the middle of it, not wait to see how it settles, not figure out how it ends, not be cautious about it, but try it. Now is the time for librarians to get out there and figure out what we can do, not what we did. The librarianship itself is a 3,000-year-long conversation. It's a conversation that has taken us from clay tablets to scrolls to manuscripts to books to CDs to DVDs to MP3s to God only knows what. And librarians have existed in that 3,000 conversation not because they didn't change, but because they changed radically. There was a committee somewhere in the Library of Alexandria debating the introduction of scrolls and how this mobile technology would eliminate their need for long-term storage. Okay. Librarianship is a profession that survives and thrives on change, on learning, on what's new, and the way you honor that profession, the way that you make that profession successful is not to keep doing what you've always done because it's tradition, but to tear down the tradition on a regular basis to do something new and better. And it doesn't mean what we did 10 years ago or 15 years ago was wrong or worthless. We would never get to the position we are now if we hadn't done that. We should celebrate when a task has accomplished its goal and replace it. We shouldn't mourn services that go away. We should celebrate, remember, tell stories about it, and be really clear that we could not have done this new thing without it. Librarianship is about change. If we are going to have Pitt survive into the next century, if we are going to have the library serve it into the next century, if we're going to have Pittsburgh be economically viable in the next 10 years, it's going to require librarians to think much bigger than what's the desk and what's the resource and what's the next Twitter feed. We must reinvent ourselves because that is what librarianship is. That is why we're professionals. That is why we are essential components of any knowledge age going forward. Thank you. Hi. I should probably sit, too. This is intimidating. Hi. I'll sit over here.
And all the library people said, amen.
There you go.
Sure. For those of you who are not in my session earlier, those of you online who want to be able to recognize my voice, I'm going to use this video. So librarians, you can I really enjoyed your talk today. Discussion on some of these incredibly important things, especially as we think about services and libraries in transition. And a couple of things struck me. One thing that, if I can paraphrase something that you said, essentially what you said was that the librarian's skill set is incredibly valuable if we abstract it beyond what we know of in our sort of day-to-day work. By which, I mean, you know, you described sort of very broad concepts of information seeking and supporting scholarship and things like that, as opposed to, you know, sitting at a reference desk and saying, please answer your question, you know, creating a MARC record, you know, the very specific details of our day-to-day work. In my experience, I feel like no one is worse at abstracting the skills of librarianship than librarians and library staff. And in part, it's because we in institutions that are, you know, perpetually understaffed and under-resourced, those day-to-day tasks consume all the available bandwidth that we have. And so it's very, very easy to mistake forest for trees.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious if you can give any ideas about how best to start thinking more broadly about the tasks that we perform on a day-to-day basis and what the broader set of skills are there that we can apply elsewhere. You know, you talked about MARC records as a sort of predicting a reference interaction. I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit more about how we can best move ourselves out of that mindset.
That's a great question. I think that librarianship, one of the blocks to getting to big ideas, in any profession, by the way, I don't want to just pick on librarians, but it's when a profession defines itself by function. This is what we do. What are you? I'm a librarian. Why? Because I work in a library. Right? That's not enough. And so we need to, I think that the three things that define what a librarian is first, our knowledge of learning, how people learn. We would have talked about it as information-seeking behavior. I think we need to put in a little bit more of a learning context. But the idea of how people go about acquiring and understanding and making sense of information, which we need to do better. The second are our skills, MARC cataloging, these kinds of things, information-seeking, Boolean. No one's born speaking Boolean, folks. We're mutants on that. And then the last one are our values. And this is one that we often talk about but undervalue. The fact that we are a principled profession, which does not mean that we are unbiased. It is impossible to be unbiased. Never use the phrase again. But we are intellectually honest. We are willing to say that we have a point of view and we're going to attempt to set it aside in our reference search, in our cataloging, these kinds of things. So those three things, and then you need a direction. And for me, that's a mission. And my mission for librarians is, the mission of librarians is to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation in the community. In fact, I'm right in the middle of a big argument with someone asking who the hell is letting librarians improve society. And all I can say is, who's against improving society? You know, no, screw society. Anyway, whatever it is. So that's a preamble to the really immediate thing, which is the way to do this is to introduce a culture of innovation. And innovation is not something you do through a committee on innovation. It is not something you do in a position as the VP of innovation. It's something you do everywhere. Someone asks, how do I have time to think broader? And the answer is, your job's to innovate in whatever you're doing. If you're in circulation and you can figure out a way to save 10 seconds off the circulation transaction, that's an innovation. Right? And if you get into the idea that you're looking for this continuous improvement process in what you're doing, then eventually you begin to look across at how it can apply others. But you've got to turn it into, all right, I know what I'm doing, right? Because I don't know about you, but, you know, I think up until yesterday, and frankly, for the next 20 years, I always walked around going, when are they going to figure out I don't know what I'm talking about? So turn that around and say, all right, I sort of, it's an advantage to walk into circulation never having done it before because I get a fresh perspective on it. So I think it's introducing the sense of innovation in what you do and not as a separate monumental activity.
And you teach in a library school. Now, you asked me, you have to go back to library school and learn how to
be a liaison.
For those people who are in a library school right now, what are you doing there to change the, are you changing the names of courses? Are you changing the way the objectives are written to have a different focus?
Our outcomes, we've moved from outputs to outcomes evaluation. That was a big change, which is, what do we want these folks to be able to do, not necessarily what did they hear? And we are, but it's not, there was a big brouhaha when Michael Gorman was ALA president, there's a crisis in education and we don't teach cataloging anymore. And then if you want to look it up, there's a great paper by Andy Dillon and someone else that went and found cataloging courses in every one, but they're called information organization courses now. And then this is the same point when he started talking about metadata is not good enough, we need cataloging. And I just sort of scratched the head and says, well, isn't cataloging a process and metadata an output? I don't get that. What the big change that we're trying to do is that we are really trying to get people energized and realizing that their greatest advantage is a new perspective on what they do. They need street skills. They need to understand what a mark record is. They need to understand reference and how to find genres. But they're learning instruction. They're learning how to teach much more than they ever did before. We want to begin introducing learning theory. The introductory course is not a history course where they learn Benjamin Franklin did this and all that. It's now an issues course where they're really learning how to do project management. They're analyzing what they're doing. They're doing marketing plans. And so it's a real shift from, as I said, the spare parts mentality, which is its vocational training, to really looking at them as professionals who are in organizational dynamics and change is really what librarians are. They're ones, because when you work with someone on a reference transaction, you work with someone on in-depth research, they're changing how they view the world. Maybe that much, maybe a lot. And so that means you're in a change process. This idea that if all together we came together and said, you know what, reference is radically different. We're throwing away all the desks. We're throwing away all the books. We're replacing them with iPads, and everyone's wearing a jetpack tomorrow. If we all agreed on that magically, our faculty would walk in here and throw you guys out and say, where are the real librarians? We need to involve the people in that change process as well. I know you guys at Pitt are talking about a change process for public services. Faculty need to be on that. Students need to be a part of that process. It needs to be a constant, ongoing dialogue with the community. I'm sorry if that went out left field, but
no, that's good. And I have a little bit of a follow up too. Oh. When I was a library school, and I've been out for 3 years, we had a cataloging course. It was called organization.
Yes.
Nobody ever called it that. We call it cataloging.
Cataloging. Our students do too.
Okay. My question: how are you actually changing this? Culture, besides just changing it on paper, are your faculty bought into that change? Is it starting to become where people are saying organizing information or whatever the new name is?
No, they call it cataloging. But what it is it's no longer MARC cataloging, right? That's what the cataloging course used to be, AACR2 and MARC, go. Now it's a matter of, here's MARC, here's Dublin Core, here's metadata, but when you talk about classification is different than subject identifiers, because subject identifiers are unique to the item and classification is to the whole. That conceptual understanding of it. And then what they do, and this is the big change in library school, ours, not everyone, but it's becoming more widespread, which is, okay, let's go do that. You know, a lot of the change is, let's go do that now. You know, let's go to, we had one situation where students were walking into, we built a new children's hospital. And they said, we probably want a library in there or something like it. Our students went and they put together a project plan, marketing plan, assessment plan for that. They ended up hiring one of the students to build it within the library. It's going into the community. It's finding the real friction of the real operation. So in the classroom, it can be more theoretical because it's coupled with much more hands-on in what they're doing. But, yeah, it's still cataloging.
I was just wondering, as you said, words are important.
It is. Well, so this is when that is a shift in the meaning of cataloging, because I know that some people have said one of the core skills of librarianship is cataloging, is information organization, bringing a homogeneity to access to a heterogeneous collection. And then people said, well, that's really human description. So I said, well, Google does cataloging. Oh, no, they don't. I said, well, they go in and they produce metadata so that you can find a resource. Information retrieval is really a cataloging exercise. Maybe not. Anyone ever use Shazam on your phone? Shazam's awesome, right? You hear a song, you don't know what it is, you hold your phone up to it, it listens for 30 seconds and come back and tells you what it is. That is the most amazing access to music ever. No cataloging record will ever be as good as humming into the phone, even if you're as bad at humming as I am. And so those kind of tools saying, that's the same thing. That's not radically different. That's not the technologist. That's librarianship. So that's trying to make those kind of connections. Yeah. It's like the OCLC environment scans. The number one word people identify with libraries is books. It begs the second question, which is, what do they mean when they say books? I mean, a lot of them sure mean physical paper. A lot of them probably mean learning. A lot of them might mean recreation. A lot of them, you know, there's a romantic notion behind books. So what does it mean? Yeah.
We want to open this to questions from the audience, both here and online, but I'm going to ask one question that I hope will is a question that's in the minds of a lot of people here, and that's in talking about this being the time for big ideas. You talked about celebrating the passage of old services and old models and things like that, and that has been one of the most difficult things for us to do at Minnesota, is to find when it is time to move on.
Yep.
And when it is time to not just add on another service, another tool, another task, but to decide, you know, we can be done mm-hmm. with this one. And part of that is because we can, as long, this is the case in Minnesota at least, as long as we have a reference desk, as long as we have public workstations, they will be used.
Hmm.
There was a lightning talk at Code for Live or something like that where somebody referred to the users of the reference desk as, I believe, self-selected freaks who are not. I'm not going to go quite that far. There is a certain segment of our user base, a certain segment of our public that will continue to prefer that
yep.
method of service till kingdom come.
Yep.
And so if we wait until people stop coming to our desk, until people stop using our service, we've probably waited far too long.
Yep.
How do we find that inflection point where we can legitimately say that it is worth letting something go, where we can justify the cost to those people who would continue to prefer to use that service?
This is not a perfect analogy, but I was at a conference where someone asked, all right, Dave, you want big changes, but big changes you should go slow with. And I said, well, think about it. You know, two soldiers run up to a minefield. First soldier drops down to his belly, slowly makes his way through the minefield, carefully checking every square inch till he gets to the other end. The other one runs through in 2 seconds flat. What's the difference? Well, the one who ran through in 2 seconds flat laid the minefield, right? The idea that if you don't have a direction, if you don't know where you're going, and I think that's more than a strategic plan. I think that is truly a worldview and a vision of what people need, moving from information to learning, right? A lot of our models, a lot of our mindset is to run around functions that we do. So how do you define a new function when you define yourself by the functions that you do? It's a self-defeating prophecy. The other one is we're around an information. We believe that those physical items out there have value in and of themselves, and they don't. They have no value until they're put into some sort of use, right? And that use is never an informing use. It's a learning use. Fiction is right up there with learning. I've learned much more about myself from Catcher in the Rye than I ever did from, you know, what color's my parachute, whatever it is. And so one is having that worldview, because if you suddenly say you're in the learning business, it changes what you do. Just like a university. My uncle said, how many classes do you teach? I said, one. He goes, that's the problem with higher education. I mean, you know, if there's a tea party, he's on the flag. But, and I said, you're making a mistake. You think that I'm at a university, that the university is about teaching. Right? We're about discovering new stuff and inviting students along the way. That's a very different perspective. Now, whether that holds up or change, it doesn't matter. But what are you guys in the job of? Archives. Is archive there to preserve for someone 500 years from now? Or are we there so that people can learn about now? Is history a product of an exact duplicate of chronological events? Or is it a set of interpretation that helps us understand the current? Right? This mindset of what we are here to do. If you're in a functional world, you can't do that. If you have a larger idea, if you're into learning, and then you put the data behind it, which is, all right, we look at, so three people will come to the reference desk until they die. We can accommodate that some other way, or whatever it is. So that's what I think it comes down to, is it sounds abstract, and it sounds like nosebleed sections to be up there, but as a professional, part of your job is to be reflective, and to think about what the larger value that you're doing. So does WebEx have any questions for us? I don't know. Are there questions? Throwing things at me. Anyone want a mint? Something? Are you in the learning business? I've had people legitimately say no. And you know, that's the point is a conversation, not an answer. I talk loudly, but that doesn't mean I know what I'm talking about. Please.
So if I'm in an augmented reality, if Rush gives me iPad and I go out,
right,
and they say, well, that's not secure.
Right.
Whatever you're doing is not secure. That's one example. So what is your advice for?
I'm a big believer in the coalitions of the willing, right, that you find folks that want to do this. And you build upon them wanting to do it. I'm also that coalition needs to be as diverse as possible. So, for example, being brutally honest, IT telling you that you can't do it because it's insecure, and IT telling a full professor over in medicine they can't do it because it's insecure is two different conversations. And so if they're part of your coalition, you know, you can move things faster. It's also a matter of aligning yourself to the organizational outcomes. So you can say, look, if we're going to be in internationalization and mobile and distance and we're not in the iPad world, hello, right? So I think that's helpful, is that you have a coalition of the willing, you're tied into what they are. And the other one is to find out how people succeed. One of the things that I've run very large scale projects, and I learned the morning for a previous task in a very visceral way. I had one librarian, we closed down this reference service, and for 5 years, any conversation I had would bring up, isn't it a shame that, right? I mean, gee, it's nice out. Oh, it is. It's sunny. Isn't it a shame that we closed that service, you know? I think I'll have turkey for lunch. Turkey's great. You know what else was great? That service that we closed down 5 years ago. And that's where you say, but what do you want to do now? And the really scary thing, and this, there is no good answer for this. The really scary thing is, what do you want to do now turns into what I've been doing for 50 years. And I don't even care about the worldview. And you can celebrate all you want, but I just don't want to go there. And that's where you have to, if you cannot find that new incentive, and 90% of the time I'm able to find a new incentive for people. Like, I don't want to use this iPad, but suddenly, my mother, an iPad? Yes, you can see your grandkids and they can walk around with you and show you tours. Okay. Right? If you can't find that incentive, then the best line I ever heard from human resources is, our job is to help you find a successful career. It just may not be here. And that's, I know that sounds vicious, and I know that sounds mean, but those negative attitudes can kill you. And the truth is, the person who has the negative attitude is not having a good time, right? So helping them find that new career path may be the way to go. Please. Yes. Yes.
And I guess I'm curious about how do we get more of that. I mean, I think we're all in an environment where work harder, vacation is considered, not here, but just overall people work suspiciously in their
business. Do more with less.
Exactly. And you might be enjoying yourself, and that's a bad idea. How do you build in reflection?
Yeah. I think there's an associated question. Play is a vital part of work. When you learn the most is when you play. You're having a good time. You're figuring out the rules. You're figuring out. So, new technology, playground, right? Try Twitter. Try whatever. Try Second Life. There's a lot of playing with Second Life. And then, though, the essential part of play is reflection. All right, what did we learn? Did it work? Didn't we? And that's good assessment mechanisms. That's having good data. But it really comes down to an organizational culture. We are really busy. Stop and ask yourself, is whatever we're busy with more important than us thinking professionally long term? Because if thinking professionally long term is a vital function for us to do it, it should be allocated, evaluated, and assessed as equal importance to the number of reference questions I asked. So I very much appreciate the fact that you guys don't have a lot of time on your hands. I absolutely appreciate that. I mean, I have to on my calendar, Tuesdays from 4 to 5, leave me alone time. And, Greenspan talked about this in his book when he was Fed chairman. He used to schedule hours where he could just think. And you're right. There's a perception that, wasting time, whatever it is. You got to show some results for it. But it's culturally to say, as someone who's overlooking public service, this is important for us to take the time. There was a discussion about dragging you here to hear me and these folks. There was a discussion about, is that worth the money, the time, the effort, because take all your salaries, multiply the hour, whatever. And they said yes. So if this is important, isn't it also important that I have a chance to play with the iPad? Isn't it also important that I have a time to just sit and think? Lunchtime. My favorite story, actually back in the birth of medicine at the Rockefeller Institute, was they used to make all the medical researchers have lunch together, and as soon as they'd sit down, someone would say, I cannot figure out, and it began a conversation around it. TEDx talks. They're all streaming, coming in and having a weekly TEDx where you pick one of the cool ones and you have a conversation around it. But it's cultural. It's got to be cultural. And that means that either it's got to come from the bottom up, depending on the existing culture, or the top down has to at the very least say, that is valuable time. You should spend it. And by the way, students and library aides as well, not just the librarians. Yeah, please.
And so I asked this group, it was about 30 sort of senior technology staff in public libraries, and I asked, how many of you have read a book on your phone? One person had. And it's because, you know, they work in a library, so they can get access to all the books they want in the format that they're accustomed to getting them all the time. And it's that... they had a really hard time, as I think we all do, getting outside of the mindset that we're familiar with and the patterns that we're familiar with, because I think that the most important work that we can do is not even in learning how to better serve the users that we've already got, but to recognize that there is, even at a university, a significant percentage of potential users that we are not serving.
Right.
And it's very difficult to figure out the shape of that, and it really does take some reflection. It takes some stepping outside of your day-to-day work. It takes trying to behave as closely as you possibly can to your users, potential users, members, whatever. And it's a challenge, but I think it's incredibly important.
Well, and preconceived notions. How many folks here, in working with someone, let's just say someone 20 years and younger, either a reference transaction, you're helping them at home, whatever, have been absolutely floored by what they didn't know about technology? Right? I have a real problem with the whole millennials notion and the digital natives language, because what I know is that they are good users, and here I'm specifically using the word user, or I could use the word consumer of technology, but that doesn't mean that they actively shape it and understand it. Remember that Google and Apple and Microsoft and all these big technology firms were run by people older than me, right? And they're shaping and working to that community, but we have to understand that that's just one. The other one is, oh, people don't like books. Or if they only know about us, they'd use us. There are people out there that hate you. You know, it's hard to take that. So knowing real data, real situations, important. I don't want to end it on people hating you, but they also love you.
Sir. Sure. There's a service that is offered somewhere, I think it's in Oakland, it's called 4Fact. And what you do, the idea is, call a number and you can ask any question, no matter what it is. I don't know where that is, but you can ask.
They call us.
They may use a reference.
They said, this is 4Fact, could you look up and
say, there you go. You can ask how long to boil an egg, you can ask when the next bus arrives. So anyway, I'm thinking that maybe, I mean, that's essentially what a library does, right? Except that we do it in a way that's specific to what our traditional conceptions are about what our functions are. But we could expand that easily in ways that help the learning conversation around us for example, the reference desk could possibly connect students to when the next faculty talks to them on the subject that they're working on. Information around universities is not specifically related to what's in the specs. And do you see that as where the reference desk is going?
I think it's essential. I think, first of all, the learning conversation is not happening around you. You are also part of a learning conversation, right? So think of the library itself is a learning conversation, which is we're learning about how to do what we do well. And that means that we all have a voice. We all can shape it. And that they, I mean, I put the, what do we call them as in the people who use us? The other one is them as in the administration. Libraries were not put, God did not sneeze and make a library with an org chart which starts with dean and works down 50 levels, right? The way we organize ourselves, the way we structure ourselves, do we have a building? Don't we have a building? How much time do we spend? What are our deliverables? What's our budget? And what do we spend budget priorities? All of that is a conversation of which we have complete control over. Budget, maybe not so much, but at least where we spend it. And so the question becomes, is amongst ourselves, how fluent and agile is that conversation? Because if we're expecting to help people do it better, we better be constantly improving our own way of doing it. So yes, that's one. And then, right, how can we be where the conversation's happening, whether they're calling us on their phones and texting it? I think the reference desk is going to quickly become a work table. And I think that work table is going to quickly become a virtual work table, which means that imagine someone walks in and they have a question, and the first thing you do is not start handing them resources. You sit them at a table. And you say, who do you want to come talk to you? Do you want a reference librarian? Fine. Do you want a professor? Do you want your friends? If you want to talk by yourself? That's fine. You got to find a book, put it in piles. And imagine if every question, and I know physically we couldn't do this, but virtually you can do it. Imagine if you said, this is my workbench for solving a problem, which is really what a reference question is. And it's got people and it's got resources. It's got stuff. It's got my crazy scribbles. It's got a whiteboard for me to work it out. It's got all of this stuff happening and then lovely tools that make sense of it and help faster. That's very different than here's Grand Poobah sitting behind high desk, right? Because if you guys sit behind a reference desk, there's got to be a time when people come up to you and just go, oh God, if it's not the bathroom, I'm going to get stuck. Oh, right? And you all have delay techniques, right? They ask you the question, you have no clue, so you send them to whatever resource you can find while you sit there, take a breath, and figure out what you're going to do next. That's putting us in a confrontational mode. Imagine a much more collaborative mode, which is, and that's why this previous, in our previous panel, Jan was talking about, she's not going to have time to sit behind a desk because she's busy out there helping people solve problems, answering the questions before they come up to a degree. It's proactive. We're always going to have folks that want the immediate question, and then maybe we need the call-up service to deal with it, but they can call me wherever, right? My cell phone follows me where I'm going. Do I need to be behind a physical desk? And last comment, because I know we're over. This is for you and your communities to decide as a conversation. This is, do not walk away and say, Dave Blanket says, burn all the reference desks. What does your community need? Does your community have an established people that need that or not? And that's a conversation and not a decision and not one abstract, but really in part of your vision. But there are libraries that should get rid of their buildings. There are libraries that should build their buildings bigger. Which are you? What are you trying to solve? Who do you need? That's the real question. It's how do we enter in and keep that conversation going and do it efficiently? You're absolutely right. Yay.